It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferriat. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk to two Wisconsin lawmakers about a bipartisan bill being voted on in the state legislature that would encourage veterans to get into farming. We'll learn more in just a bit.
First, it's time for our weekly look at the top stories in national politics.
After the terror attack in Lower Manhattan yesterday, President Trump was quick to criticize a lottery program for immigrants to the United States and the lawmakers he said had supported it.
I am today starting the process of terminating the diversity lottery program. I'm going to ask Congress to immediately initiate work to get rid of this program.
We'll look more closely at the president's remarks on immigration later today on Central Time.
And Washington is still at the center of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. This week, George Papadopoulos pleaded guilty to lying to investigators who were part of Mueller's investigation.
You can share your thoughts on either of those stories by calling 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think of the president's calls to end the diversity visa lottery program? Should the president be singling out lawmakers who backed it? And what are your thoughts on the latest on the Mueller probe? Call 800-642-1234.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian, and she's back with us to look at those stories and more. Sabrina, nice to have you back on the show again.
Thanks for having me. Happy.
Yep. Sabrina, are you still with us?
Yes, I am. Thank you so much for having me.
Great. Well, I want to talk first about the president's response to the attack in New York City. One of the responses from the president turning to look at Chuck Schumer, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and how he may, according to the president, have been attached to the diversity visa lottery program. What has the president said there?
Well, there are a couple key points here, and one is that when the president tweeted that the suspected attacker in New York came through what is known as the Diversity Immigrant Visa Program, also referred to as the Green Card Lottery, that was not something U.S. officials had confirmed themselves. Now, obviously, the president has access to classified information, but this was another example of him disseminating that information on Twitter, which is a way he often communicates. And Chuck Schumer was he played a key role in crafting this program in the early 1990s. It essentially is to boost immigration from countries where you have significantly lower rates of people coming to the United States. So up to 55,000 visas are distributed annually to a random assortment of countries. But that is not to say that those individuals do not go through background checks. In fact, they are subject to a pretty significant and lengthy vetting process. And also, it's worth noting this was passed, the visa program, diversity visa program, as part of a broader immigration bill with overwhelming bipartisan support and signed by President George H.W. Bush, who, of course, is a Republican himself.
Well, so specifically, how connected is Senator Schumer to that program?
Well, I would say that, you know, he, of course, was part of the lawmakers who were involved in shaping what it looked like back in the early 1990s. I mean, as mentioned, it was established under the Immigration Act of 1990. But there have been concerns that the program does not have maybe sufficient information from some of these countries with respect to alleviating some of the national security concerns. So there have been lawmakers who suggested revisiting this, and one of those lawmakers is Chuck Schumer himself, because the Comprehensive Immigration Reform Bill, the so-called Gang of Eight Bill in 2013, that was very hotly debated and contested in the Senate, that would have actually eliminated this diversity visa program. And Chuck Schumer was one of the Democratic co-sponsors of that bill. So there are some key facts that are being left out of this narrative in a highly unusual way, in fact, for this terrorist attack to be politicized, which inherently terrorist attacks are politicized nowadays, but specifically, for a member of an opposing party or any party to be targeted as the reason why an attack would transpire. That's highly unusual.
And how has Senator Schumer responded to the president's tweets about him?
Well, I think that Senator Schumer, in his remarks on the he took the Senate floor this morning, and in his remarks tried to draw a contrast between President Trump And President George W. Bush, of course, who was in office at the time of 9/11, not only the last terrorist attack in New York City, but of course, the largest terrorist attack the United States has dealt with. And he said that, you know, President Bush at the time invited both me and Hillary Clinton, then also a senator from New York, to the White House. He put forth a message of unity. So I think Schumer's tactic here is to not really engage on the merits of the specific visa program, and something that is a lot more in the weeds politically and will be debated potentially in the coming weeks or months. But, you know, I think that one of the things you also saw was Jeff Flake, who, you know, is a Republican senator from Arizona, who said he would retire last week from the Senate, and who's a vocal critic of Trump. He also came to Schumer's defense on Twitter because he was part of that 2013 Gang of Eight effort, and said to the president, well, you know, Chuck Schumer was part of this bill that I also co-sponsored that would have ended this program, which was his way, a Republican's way of saying that this attack is out of bounds and also misleading.
Sabrina Siddiqui is with us right now. She's a political reporter for The Guardian as we look back at the top stories this week in national politics. And Sabrina, former Trump aide George Papadopoulos pleaded guilty to lying to federal agents who worked on Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. What effect has his indictment have, or what is it expected to have?
Well, I think that this was actually the bigger bombshell on Monday, because Paul Manafort is someone who we knew was the subject of Robert Mueller's inquiry, the former campaign manager, of course, of the Trump campaign. But someone like George Papadopoulos was not really in the spotlight. And it was certainly not known that he's already been cooperating with the FBI since at least July. And I think that this really sent a signal to other individuals, whether they're associates of the Trump campaign or just individuals who figure into this broader inquiry into Russian interference in the U.S. election, that you have a choice here. You can either cooperate with the special counsel, or, you know, we could bring you in on more significant charges, especially because there are witnesses now who are working with federal agents. And the fact of the matter is that those who are somewhat connected to this Russia investigation, and certainly those who are the subject of it, they don't know what Robert Mueller knows. Only he knows what he knows so far. And so I think that kind of putting out Papadopoulos is a way of potentially attracting bigger fish, so that, you know, they could potentially reach a plea deal if they're willing to cooperate, and certainly if they're willing to hand over documents and other information that could help determine if there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Moscow.
And the White House so far has been saying that George Papadopoulos was kind of a bit player, didn't have a big role, minimizing his role in the campaign. Is that message still the tack that they're taking?
Well, that has certainly been the message they've put out, not just with respect to Papadopoulos, but also with respect to Paul Manafort. Now, with Paul Manafort, when you're talking about the former chairman of the campaign who was brought into that role during the Republican National Convention, where Trump formally accepted the nomination, that's a more difficult of an argument to make. Papadopoulos, of course, is a lesser-known figure. They also tried to do the same with Carter Page, that these are low-level foreign policy advisors who weren't really instrumental to the campaign. But the problem is that there is audio of Trump introducing his foreign policy advisory team, mentioning people like Papadopoulos and Carter Page by name. There is a photo in which Papadopoulos is seated at the table with Trump just a few feet away. So they can't argue that there was really no contact between Papadopoulos and, forget senior figures in the campaign, but the candidate himself. Also, he reported to Sam Clovis, who was in a much higher ranking position in the campaign and is now actually a nominee, or Trump's nominee, to be the chief scientist at the Department of Agriculture. So that too might become a contentious nomination.
Now, these indictments have been framed as the first indictments, and we had a guest on yesterday who said that there were maybe whispers that there would be indictments coming down as of last week, Wednesday. Are you hearing anything else now that would indicate that there might be more action coming up?
I think there certainly are expected to be more indictments, but it seems like the tactic here on Mueller's part is as we just alluded to, trying and compelling more witnesses to come forward. It's sort of that classic move on the part of the FBI when they're going after a mob that, you know, if you bring people in on, if you go after people on other charges, in the case of Manafort and Gates, there are many charges listed among them, money laundering and the tax evasion and other such charges. They're not specifically related to Russian interference in the U.S. election. That's a way to sort of force them to be cooperators. And I think that that's sort of the signal before any more indictments come down, so that if there are others, certainly someone like Michael Flynn, who has so far avoided cooperating in any way with Mueller or even or investigators on Capitol Hill, that, you know, if you don't want to be indicted, there's still an opportunity here to come forward.
Sabrina Siddiqui stays with us now. She's a political reporter at The Guardian as we look at the top stories in national politics for a weekly look at politics out of Washington.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think of the president's calls to end the diversity visa lottery program? If you're following the Russia probe, tell us, what do you think of the indictments announced earlier this week? What do you think it means? What do you think of the president's response to both of these issues? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our look at the week in Washington with Sabrina Siddiqui, political reporter for The Guardian.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think of the political response, the White House response to yesterday's attack in New York? How about the indictments in the Mueller investigation? What are you watching for? What do you think of what's happened lately? And what do you think of Chief of Staff, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly's remarks on the Civil War this week? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
Let's take one call on the Mueller investigation. We've got Mike joining us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to ask your guest about Manafort's daughter and son-in-law and how Mueller might leverage Manafort to, I guess, giving up more information in order to protect his daughter, and also how would Mueller leverage the state courts, New York State, in order to keep Trump from simply being able to pardon Manafort or his daughter in any federal indictment?
Mike, thank you for that. And Sabrina, have you heard anything about Paul Manafort's family?
Yes, the reason that his daughter is at the subject of the headlines is because she reportedly texted friends about how close her father, Paul Manafort, was to Trump during the campaign. And so that actually undermines the White House argument that Paul Manafort was somewhat distant from the campaign and didn't really know or work closely with Trump himself, when in fact the public record shows that Manafort and Trump have known each other for decades. So, you know, these are certainly, I don't know in terms of how his family might be involved, but they're certainly potential witnesses. It's not out of the question that they would potentially be called for an interview with the FBI. As far as the question is about pardons, I think that it's not out of the realm of possibility that the president pardons Paul Manafort. That is something that he has the power to do. But I think that what I'm hearing from Republicans on Capitol Hill is it would be highly unwise for the president to pardon any of these high-profile figures in this investigation, or frankly speaking, any of the individuals whose names have been put out by the special counsel, because that would be directly interfering with the investigation, and that could be a red line even for Republicans who so far have tried to keep out of the president's way and tried not to focus too much on this inquiry.
Mike, thanks a lot for that call. And Sabrina, let's talk taxes now. News this morning that the GOP tax plan reveal is getting delayed. Looks like maybe tomorrow. What do we know about why?
Well, there are a number of disagreements over the tax plan, specifically how do you pay for these tax cuts? And there are some revenue generators that the Republicans have identified, one of which is to eliminate the state and local tax deduction. But you have Republicans from high tax states, for example, New York, New Jersey, some in even Pennsylvania, who are highly opposed to eliminating those particular deductions. So that's one sticking point. And I think they're looking for some sort of assurance that even if this is removed from the House version, that it's not reinstated when the Senate takes up a bill, if they're able to pass something through the House. And then you have the fiscal conservatives who believe that this is not what they campaigned on, because it certainly, according to analyses, would balloon the deficit. And this party has run on fiscal responsibility. So I think that you've got a number of concerns that are holding it up at the moment. And the question really is, are we looking at healthcare 2.0 or maybe even 3.0? We already had two versions of healthcare, but is this going to similarly fall to divisions within the Republican Party and not even make it pass through the Senate? Right now, it's not even clear if this is going to come up for a vote anytime soon in the House.
And Republicans need a win, as you referenced, after failures on health care. And this has been seen as lower hanging fruit, something that should be doable to get to some point of consensus. And the president has been weighing in, saying he wants real progress on this, wants it pretty much done before the holidays. Does it seem likely that that will happen?
Well, it's hard to imagine that this entire issue will be dealt with before the holidays. I mean, if you look back, for example, at health care, the House did ultimately pass its own version of an Obamacare repeal, but only because the moderates who had raised concerns with the House bill wanted to kick it over to the Senate and said, the Senate will fix this bill, they'll improve it, and then they'll send it back to us. As we know with health care, the Senate didn't even take up the House bill. They started to put forth their own plans. Those all fell apart, and then the issue was just tabled. So I think that, you know, what you could see is House Republicans do something similar where they can go back to their districts and say that they passed something. Maybe if they are able to resolve these differences, they bring something to the floor for a vote, or they just say, again, we're going to kick this over to the Senate. You know, we've done our part. Now they can do theirs. And again, you'll run into even more obstacles with the Senate, where there's only 52 Republicans in the chamber. They can only afford to lose two votes under this simple majority process known as reconciliation. And so I just how it's foreseeable that they would be able to act this quickly, especially because not only have they not resolved divisions within their own party, but they're also out on recess for quite a bit of time, too. So there's a very limited time for them to get this done.
And another important story in a week of important stories, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly has been the subject of controversy for remarks he made about the Civil War. And here's a clip of what he said in an interview with Laura Ingraham.
Well, history's history. There's certain things in history that were not so good and other things that were very, very good. I would tell you that Robert E. Lee was an honorable man. He was a man that gave up his country to fight for his state, which in 150 years ago was more important than country. It was always loyalty to state first back in those days. Now it's different today. But the lack of an ability to compromise led to the Civil War.
So Kelly saying the lack of ability to compromise led to the Civil War. This has been very contentious. People having very different reactions. What have you seen?
Well, I think that this certainly prompted a pretty swift criticism because in some ways it harkened back to the president blaming both sides in the wake of the attack in Charlottesville, suggesting they were very fine people on both sides. Obviously, people's views have shifted, the public's views have shifted significantly with respect to the Confederacy and the two sides within the Civil War. And there's also a bit of revisionist history here, of course, because suggesting that there was an inability to compromise overlooks a long history of compromises that were made to reflect pro-slavery forces. Not to mention, critics have pointed out, if you're looking back at this today, I mean, the fundamental question was whether or not people were willing to compromise on the issue of enslavement. So I think that, you know, it's unclear why the chief of staff is out here wading into these culture wars. It's also maybe more telling that John Kelly, who has been very much framed as an adult in the room and has tried to instill discipline in the White House, in many ways, people believe that there's been more and more evidence as he puts himself out there that he's more of a believer and from more of an ideological standpoint in this president and the message on that he has put out on issues of immigration, criminal justice, race relations. So I don't think this is a conversation that the White House wanted to have. In fact, you just had at today's briefing, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, say that it's deeply offensive that anyone would suggest that any individual in the White House is in favor of slavery. And the fact that she even had to make that statement speaks to the conversation that is being had in the White House, much less in 2017.
And Sabrina, lastly, in our last minute together here, former President Barack Obama is no longer in office, obviously, but that doesn't mean he's kicking back. His foundation has been swinging into higher gear, looking at getting involved in civics. What's the foundation doing?
Well, this, I think, is going back to the roots for former President Obama, who, of course, began, as a community organizer, focusing on the political process and how do you get more people engaged to be especially young activists and part of the civic culture. I think one of the things that he's focusing on is the breakdown of our politics. And he did this in much more veiled terms through his foundation. I don't think he wants it to be a very political. So he didn't name Trump. He's stuck with his policy of not naming President Trump since leaving office in January. But certainly I think he was trying to speak to this as a pivotal moment, why more and more people should be engaged in the democratic process if they do want to be agents of change.
Sabrina, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sabrina Siddiqui is a political reporter for The Guardian, joining us for our Week in Washington segment.